Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was back in 1971 that Intel would release the 4004, a microprocessor, effectively laying the ground as the first commercially available microprocessor and the foundation of what we would know as the modern computing industry. Fast forward to today, and just recently, the US government has taken almost a 10% stake in Intel, investing almost $9 billion off of the instructions and recommendations of one President Trump. That is a story for another day, perhaps. For today, though, I'm Jimmy Moya. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest from the Auditor General's office. You would have heard in that news, in the latest news update, that the AG's office has concluded their audit of local municipalities. We're going to review some of those findings and see if we can make sense of where they put the municipalities of the country. We also have a conversation with the South African Bitumen Association, taking a look at the role of bitumen in the South African economy as we look to industrialize and invest more in infrastructure development. Then we have a conversation with the Financial Sector Conduct Authority on their decision to provisionally withdraw a financial services provider license for a licensed entity. We're going to take a look at that as part of our Warning Wednesdays and see why it is that they took that decision and what we can learn from it. We have a conversation with the LPG Association, the Liquefied Petroleum Gas Association of South Africa, on the compliance and regulatory requirements of LPG sales and storage, amongst other things, off the back of the rise in the illicit LPG market that we have been seeing. We speak to the Chief Executive Officer of the LPGSA around that. And we wrap up the show, as we do every Wednesday, with an Executive Lounge conversation. This week, we're going to get to know the Chief Executive Officer of Discovery Life a little bit better.
The Day's Markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
That's where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements. As always, I'm joined on the line by Otto 1890's David Shapiro to take a look at markets and see what to make of them. Uncle David, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. I think all the news out of today has to be that the gold price, as it currently stands as well, below $4,000 a fine ounce.
Yeah, well, that's the bad news. The good news is that oil's coming down, so you can choose your poison.
I'll take the oil price coming down.
Well, the oil price is coming down dramatically on, you know, the prospect of of the opening up of the Straits of Hormuz, and ships are starting to flow through there. So I think we've seen, you know, quite a heavy fall in oil, and that's had consequences in other markets outside of us. But remember, gold was the metal that drove our market up last year, you know, and it reached something like, 5,300 when the fighting broke out in Iran. And it's now, as you say, 4,000. That's, 20% down. And the problem is that gold shares are more highly geared than 20% to the gold price. So we've seen a massive fall in them. In fact, platinum's come down more than gold. You know, platinum was 2,800 when America attacked Iran. It's now 1,700. So that's the downside of it. But, you know, in the long run, that's what you get with gold and platinum. It's nothing new historically to see these kind of movements. But I think if we look through that, Jimmy, you know, if with oil coming down the line, it has to have some impact on inflation. I'm talking negative inflation or prices coming down, and just help the consumer here. You know, so I'm more inclined to look at the oil price, you know, rather than worry about the gold price.
Uncle David, let's look into that oil price in a bit more detail. I had a quick look at a chart whilst you were telling us about that. 16 weeks ago, yep, was the last time we saw the oil price at this level, February of this year. Since March, yep, we have been above $75 a barrel. Now, yes, we haven't got written confirmation from both parties that the peace deal is in effect. We know we're anticipating that this deal will be wrapped up anytime soon, but the market very, very clear in its movements that they expect this deal to go ahead and that this is what is best for the market.
Yeah, exactly that. You know, I think the market is anticipatory. It's very smart. I mean, you get it's a combination of a huge number of people sharing their views, and you've got American, what's a WTI, West Texas down below 70, and Brent the last time I looked just 73 and a half, and heading towards where we were before the war. Yes, we've got this interim period which is going to cause a little bit of problems, and but I mean down the line, if things do stabilize, it's going to have a big impact. We're seeing it, you know, and you already, Jimmy, you see it play out. I've been looking at the European market, and one of the areas of our market that was up today, remember gold and platinum shares came under a lot of pressure, but the area of the market that was up are our big foreign listed industrials, AB InBev, Richemont, a luxury goods company, British American Tobacco, Prosus and Naspers up, which was good to see. And you know, business like MTN and Vodacom and so on, those that are geared to consumer spending and, you know, not necessarily in South Africa. So I it you know, that's the good news. The markets there are responding. I looked at luxury goods now in the Europe as well. It's an area that's been hurt and taken down by concerns about high oil prices and spending and the end of travel or people not, you know, not traveling or no tourists and so on. And that's reversing as well. So the market's looking ahead. I would expect if this continues that we will start to see our consumer side, you know, the consumer side of our market finding some kind of bottom. And picking up from there as we look ahead. I'm not, you know, as we look forward to rates perhaps stabilizing, coming down. It'd be very silly, if I may say so, you know, for the Reserve Bank now to keep raising to keep raising rates against this kind of backdrop. I hope someone's listening there with a little more sense.
We will definitely pass the message on, Uncle David, and I'm sure they'll listen to you. Speaking of the central bank and speaking of those decisions, we know that from a central bank perspective, locally and internationally, a lot of the rates conversations happen from a longer term perspective.
Yeah.
Given that we have been in the midst of this war for a little over 4 months, how much of the inflation conversation has been priced in, and perhaps how much of it still needs to filter into the market? And could that be why central banks might be a bit hesitant to cut rates so soon?
I think they've, you know, they've also got to think ahead. I know that they're very data dependent and driven by, you know, their academic view on, well, their views on monetary policy, and they know a lot more than I do. But I think, you know, what was interesting, just reflecting on what you're saying, our yields are coming down. Our bond yields, the long bond yields, are actually down and performing very well. I'm talking about our 10-year bond yields and that. I thought they would be under a bit of pressure. I was a little shaken by Kevin Warsh, you know, the Fed governor last week when he gave his talk, and you know, he's re-looking at a whole lot of areas that influence their decisions, also taking a hawkish stand. And I thought there would be more impact in the market, and I think we've kind of dismissed it and said, okay, he's going for price stability, you know, which is a vi which is an area which is very important in America at the moment. I'm watching the primary elections, or the Democratic Party's primary elections, and a lot of it is around affordability, and all that the consumer wants is you know, are stable prices. So I you know, I'm quite happy with the way that oil prices are performing, and I would expect it to start to reflect on our market sentiment as well, if it can hold. You know, you never know with Trump and Rand, you never know what can happen tomorrow, but I think he's been tamed, and I think this deal will take place.
I hope that part of the conversation is not heard by one President Donald Trump, because we don't know how he'll respond to that. For now, we'll take the win that is markets looking a little more improved despite commodity prices coming down significantly. We'll have to wait and see what this means for markets going into the rest of the week. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Otto 1890's David Shapiro joining us to reflect on markets, some of the big movers on the day, and what might be driving them.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is
Sega.
Surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Auditor General's Office of South Africa released today its audit findings of local municipalities. Only 39 of our local municipalities were able to receive a clean audit, according to the AG's report. More concerning than that is that the state of metros over the last 5 or so odd years has deteriorated in terms of the quality of the audit findings there. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the head of audit at the Auditor General's Office of South Africa, Sharon Adams. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Sharon, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an overview of the findings from the AG's office across the municipalities. Any standout performers there?
Jimmy, and good evening to the listeners. So we've seen for the current year that we've got very limited progress over this administration. However, we've seen some green shoots in some improvements. So the first one that we would like to mention is the timely submission of the financial statements, where we've seen an improvement from 82 to 98% in the current year. Furthermore, the second one is a reduction of our disclaimed municipalities. When we started the administration, there was about 29 disclaimed municipalities, and that was reduced to 8 municipalities. And these are undesirable audit outcomes that we would not like to see. Of this, 8, there's 7 repeat disclaimers that's been in the disclaim zone for about 3 to 10 years. What we have seen, these improvements in terms of the submission of the financial statements and those of the disclaimed audit opinions, is all the intervention from both national and the provincial perspective, the roles that the premiers, the COCTAs, the treasuries and legislatures and parliament play to play their role in terms of the accountability ecosystem. Furthermore, one of the other green shoots that we've seen, we've got about 61% of our municipalities in the unqualified zone with findings. That is quite a significant improvement. However, of concern, Jimmy, to us and the listeners, is the areas of regressions that we've seen. So we've seen a regression in the space of the clean audit from 41 to 39 clean audits, only representing 15%. Further regressions that we have seen specifically in the space of the metros, where we find that there is no metro municipality with clean audit outcomes, and we've got 3 basically in the unqualified zone, which is City of Cape Town, eThekwini and City of Joburg. And these municipalities, these metros, serves about 46% of the household and is responsible for 54% of the budget. I think furthermore, if we look at these metro municipalities, they take responsibility for about 73 billion of the regular expenditure over the administration, and in the current year, 23 billion of irregular expenditure. So what we have clearly seen in the space of a metro, a clear demonstration where institutionalization of controls is not implemented. There's no regard for compliance to the law. Officials are not behaving ethically. There's conflict of interest, and they always don't act in the best interest of the institution. And we've seen the number of unauthorized irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure growing on a consistent basis with no proper accountability and consequence management that takes place in this regard. The other interesting one in terms of movement in the audit outcomes, overall we see a 72 municipalities improve and 38% regress. But however, when we look at the budgets of these municipalities, the regressions is more in the 38, which basically deals with 149 billion of the budget compared to the improvement of 82 billion of the budget, which basically indicates to you the municipality that regressed actually holds portion of the biggest budget compared to those ones that has improved.
Now, Sharon, part of those regressing municipalities are, of course, our metros. They have been performing worse than they were at the start of this particular reporting term. Over the last 5 years, we've seen a significant deterioration in their performance. Can we look at that in a bit more detail and look at why that is so concerning? The metros are surely supposed to be those that have more resources and perhaps even those that are able to set the example for the smaller municipalities.
Jimmy, 100% right. So when we look at the audit outcomes for the metro, as I've indicated, there's three basically that's got unqualified audit opinions. So what we have seen in the current year, a regression specifically with the City of Cape Town that had findings on procurement and contract management that they are addressing and dealing with. When we specifically look at eThekwini Metro, and this has been a metro that has been in the unqualified zone for a number of years. So throughout these metros, we see consistently findings in the area of non-compliance to laws and regulation with specific emphasis on procurement and contract management, where procurement prescripts are not appropriately followed in these cases. For example, in the case of City of Joburg, we see they've got an unqualified audit, but this was mainly due to the entities across their sphere, basically, that received this unqualified audit. But as a standalone audit, City of Joburg would have obtained a qualified audit opinion. And similarly, when we look at the other metros that's in the qualified zone, which is the rest of them, there again, we don't see any culture of clear performance, knowing that you perform your work in terms of your mandate. There's no clear accountability that we find. So when we basically engage with these metros many times, we find we issue repeat findings. And then furthermore, from a transparency perspective, when you even look at their performance report, there's only two metros that basically receive a clean bill of health when it comes to the service delivery, which is the performance information report. Furthermore, when we look specifically at the metro in terms of their rate of responsiveness to our findings, even in some of the instances where we've issued material irregularities, the rate of responsiveness is very, very slow. So that is one of the key challenges, some of the key challenges that we find in the metros, and they are the ones, as you correctly said, that basically has the biggest budgets, and also from a skills and capability perspective, should have better skills and capability based on where they are centered, but still one that we find quite a bit of challenges with.
Sharon, if we're looking at what needs to be done going forward, we have seen some signs of improvement in some areas, but we've also seen an increase in the use of consultants, significantly impacting how much is spent on consultants to prepare financial statements and to do things that municipalities employ other individuals to do. How do we improve this? How do we improve the audit quality, simultaneously the financial management of municipalities, such that we're able to achieve better audit outcomes?
So, Jimmy, when we specifically look at the spend of consultants, once again, we see an increase since the start of the administration to now. For this year, there was about 1.6 billion that has been spent in the cost of consultants. What we further see then when these consultants are basically utilized, so it's in 68% of the instances that we see recurring appointments of consultants that is appointed in the municipalities. Majority of the cases, the reasons for the appointment of consultants is because of skills and vacancies, or not having appropriate skills, or having vacancies in place. That was one of the key reasons why these consultants were appointed. When you dig a bit deeper to get an understanding when these consultants are appointed, what do these consultants actually do? So a lot of the work that the consultants then does is looking many times at underlining basic information that was supposed to be done on a daily and monthly and quarterly basis, like asset management, accounting services that they do, preparation of financial statements, even in some instances, tax services that we see that they do. And in this case, we find a lot of times when we actually assess from our perspective, looking at when these consultants was utilized, we still find in majority of the cases that the audit outcomes are not improving. that then the findings then still remain the same. So in many of the cases that we find that the work on the, of the consultant is not adequately reviewed by the respective municipalities that they put where when they appoint consultants. Sometimes when they appoint these consultants, they don't even do proper needs assessment to say, why do we need consultants? And in other cases, they actually appoint consultants knowing they don't have the documents available. So in many cases, we've actually started issuing material irregularities, about 33 of them, where we've actually indicated you are not using consultants effectively, and there should be a process in place when you're appointing these consultants. So these are instances where we've seen proper processes wasn't followed, proper accountability wasn't driven when it came to the appointment of consultants.
Greater accountability and audit improvements required by municipalities or from municipalities and required urgently. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Head of Audit at the Auditor General's Office of South Africa, Sharon Adams, joining us to take a look at the conclusion of municipal audits, or local municipality audits rather, and the outcomes thereof.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
With crude oil prices coming down, it looks as though we are potentially in line for that petrol price decrease that we've so desperately been waiting for. But something else that we don't often discuss related to the crude oil price, and this is probably because even though this particular product comes from a barrel of crude oil, depending on how it is that that barrel is processed and refined, many of us don't know in South Africa what it even is. I'm referring to something called bitumen. It is something that is critical to our infrastructure and our infrastructure development plans that we have. And in being critical, it is potentially under threat with the amount of importing we need to do there relative to the amount of work that needs to be put in on the ground. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Bitumen Association, Melanie Kemp-Hofmeyer, to take a look at this and see what we know about this. Melanie, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. For those that haven't had the privilege of encountering this particular commodity, what is bitumen?
Well, Jimmy, we drive on it every day. So if you use any of our surface roads, the black roads, as that some kids will call it, it is the material that holds the asphalt together and helps create the durability of a road surface that we use in South Africa every day. And while many people may not recognize the name bitumen, it is one of the most important materials underpinning our transport infrastructure network.
Melanie, this then sounds like this is something that is critical not just for the roads that we drive on, but also for the construction sector. How much bitumen goes into the South African economy at the moment, and where do we get it from?
Well, I think it depends on what the work numbers is that is running out. But at the moment, 100% of our bitumen is imported. And Sabita, as the organization that actually underpins the industry, has actually initially, when importing started, indicated that this may be a risk. But to date, it has been adapted. And the supply chain of this importation has been invested in by the industry, and 100% of bitumen that we use in our construction industry is currently imported. Many of our construction companies also have the availability of their own stock that they keep to ensure that there is sufficient stock of bitumen available.
Now, Melanie, I'm just thinking about some of the other use cases that we use this particular commodity for. I mean, we touched on construction, we touched on the road side of it, but if I think about it, if we're talking roads and anything that a moving form of transport moves on, that would include airfields and airports. It might also include where we put asphalt, such as on roofing and all of that in domestic cases. Clearly, this is something that we can ill afford to have a supply chain disruption from. How has the market been faring with all of the tensions in the Middle East in terms of how we've been managing our supply locally?
Well, Jimmy, when we think about supply, I think the important aspect is to, if we look at construction and roads and airports and parking lots, so anything where you see the black surface is to know that the market has adapted. It's ensured that there's logistical processes that ensures there's enough bitumen available. And we don't actually get all our supply from the Middle East. If it's necessary, we get it from Europe or we get it from somewhere else. So we have adapted quite well to ensure that there is enough bitumen available. In contrast, even though there is many that is worried about it, from our side as the South African Bitumen Association, we are not ultimately worried about that there is a limited amount of bitumen available. We feel that there is sufficient supply, the supply chain processes is in place, and our members and other members have sufficient to be able to provide the products which is produced from bitumen to the construction sector.
Melanie, you mentioned that we import about 100% of our bitumen at this stage. I remember a time back in 2015, all through to just before the pandemic, where we had a significant amount of locally produced bitumen. If we are to look at the government's plans of 1 trillion rand to be invested in infrastructure expenditure over the next 3 years, clearly the need for a commodity like bitumen becomes ever so important at this stage. Is it worthwhile from a country perspective and from an economy perspective to potentially explore or re-explore locally produced bitumen? And if so, how do we do that?
Yeah, Jimmy, I think it is a supply and demand aspect, but there's a lot of aspects that we maybe not think about when we're thinking producing bitumen. And yes, nobody says that if there is someone that is willing to reintroduce that you cannot consider producing bitumen in South Africa. The question is that the investment to re-establish it locally, is there value in that? If you consider the value of investment that the private sector has put into the importation business in terms of ensuring that there is sufficient supply from external purposes. So that is ultimately a business decision that will have to come. The questions and the differences from the past is that the environmental legislation has changed dramatically. And so for that purposes, there's a lot of extra aspects that will have to be taken into account should there be reintroducing or relooking at producing it locally. Ultimately, the question is not if you are producing it locally or if we are importing it. Ultimately, the question for the road user and for clients that use the product is the quality correct? And in Sabita's role, that is where a lot of work has gone into recently to ensure that there's quality measures that the quality of the bitumen from wherever it is sourced, if it's local or if it is international, that quality is good. As example, we even promote that when they do import it, that they look at the same crude oil sources to ensure that there is a distinguishment between the quality of the bitumen that is ultimately received. And I think that is important for our road users and our people out there, that ultimately we use products that meet requirement, so that we're not preparing a bottle today so that it is there again tomorrow. And I think a lot of investment and time has been to ensure the technical ability is known of what needs to be in the supply of the bitumen.
The one commodity South Africans perhaps don't realize just how much they need it, given that it is the one commodity that holds our potholes together and prevents them from occurring if it is sourced of a high quality. And that is why the South African Bitumen Association exists, its members exist, and why it is so critical to our infrastructure initiatives as a country. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer at Sabita, Melanie Kemp-Hofmeyer, joining us to take a look at the role of bitumen in the South African economy.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Warning Wednesday. This is the part of the show where we do our bit to help consumers stay aware of what has been taking place out there and how it is that they can stay safe if they are looking to protect themselves. Now, I have just seen quite an interesting announcement by the Financial Sector Conduct Authority notifying the public that they have provisionally withdrawn the FSP license of a company called MixiRight. We're going to be taking a look at this, amongst other things, as usual for this particular conversation. I'm joined on the line by the Divisional Head of Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, Gerard van Deventer. Gerard, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. MediRight, the business was under investigation by the FSCA. That investigation has been ongoing for quite some time. And as it stands, as of today, as of a couple of hours ago or even less, their FSCA license has been provisionally withdrawn. What happened here and why did the FSCA take the decision to withdraw this license?
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy and listeners. So MixiRight is a licensed entity. I think that's the first very important point. So we have the responsibility to keep a much closer eye on regulated entities. After all, they have our license. That should create some comfort. In this case, Jimmy, what was of great concern is that we started getting complaints from their clients. And the pattern that we saw was a very familiar pattern. We might have spoken about it before. It's just the whole issue of hard sell people being driven to invest funds or to trade on the platform that they intermediate for. And then if people lose money, they are then being driven to commit more money and so forth. And all of that just adds up to very bad advice, no suitability checking. And to start off with, Jimmy, as we all know, CFDs trading on a platform is already a very high risk financial product, and it's not suitable to most South Africans. So if you get this type of behavior, that is a great concern. And that's why we stepped in and we started the investigation. You're right, it's been a while. It's a massive investigation to get involved in, and it was done entirely by my internal team. And where we are now is we've got to the point where we have enough information and evidence to be very concerned about the safety of the public. And that's why, although the investigation is not completed, we decided we are going to provisionally withdraw the license. They will have an opportunity, of course, to provide reasons why it should not be finally withdrawn. But the investigation is continuing, so there's likely to be more sanctions in the long run. This is just the first step in that direction.
Well, Gerard, can we take a look at why it is that the FSCA would then provisionally suspend a license whilst investigations are ongoing? What part of the suspension is designed at protecting consumers whilst the rest of the investigation is underway?
So basically, if you want to impose sanctions, you have to follow proper and fair administrative process. And to do that, it means you have to properly investigate. We do get complaints and we investigate it and it turns out that there's nothing to it. So it's very important to be completely unbiased and fair. But what sometimes happens, as in this case, is somewhere during this investigation, you don't only realize that there is a problem, but you also realize as the FSCA that there is an ongoing harm and risk to the public. And that is when we use this very specific instrument of a provisional withdrawal and not wait until the end of the investigation, because this is a company that's currently operating. So the harm that we see is certainly ongoing.
Speaking of that harm, Gerard, can we take a look at how much more harmful it is when organizations use licensed entities to do this? Because as you rightly mentioned, when an entity is licensed, there is an element of trust that is inherently afforded to that entity that it is regulated by the FSCA. But we're seeing more and more, alongside things like the impersonations you and I have discussed, that individuals and entities are using licensed entities now to commit these acts against consumers.
Oh, that is unfortunately so true, Jimmy, and you and I have spoken about it before. This is certainly a trend that we're seeing at the moment. It's not this unknown web-based fraudster that will disappear and that's running a scam. there's a much better way to do things, if I can put it that way. And what we see these days is that our local financial services providers, and of course I'm talking about licensed, authorized financial service providers, our brokers, in other words, they are being infiltrated. And when they are so infiltrated, the fraudsters has access to a licensed entity. And they will either then ask to extend the license to derivative trading, CFDs, or that license will already be there. And that's step one. And that's the comfort, as you mentioned, that's created, because I am now dealing with somebody that has an FSCA license, so I should have that comfort. And as you know, Jimmy, we put out so many warnings, and we always end off that warning by saying, make sure you deal with a regulated entity. So I suppose it's a bit of reaction to that as well. Now it looks as if they're dealing with a legitimate regulated entity. So that's the first step of this process. The second step of that is then, of course, you team up with a typical boiler room type of situation, a hard sell call center situation, where clients under the name of the financial services provider are then being called and cold calling, hard sell, to actually commit their money. And these people are experts at what they do. So that combination is absolutely deadly. And if you then combine that further with an impersonation or false information, false returns, etc., then you have a really bad combination for the public. And it'll be very difficult for the public to distinguish between the real thing and not the real thing. Best we can do always is to remind the public that an unrealistic return, you should just stay away from that. That is the biggest red flag that you can have. And to always contact the FSCA if you have any doubt.
When in doubt, phone a friend. Don't send your money. This is exactly why we have these conversations on the show. This is exactly why this problem continues to be a problem that escalates. And if we don't do something about it, we're going to continue to find that South Africans are the victims of these financial schemes. We're going to have to leave this conversation on that note. Divisional Head of Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, Gerard van Diefenter, joining us to take a look at the provisional suspension of Mixi, right, the reasons the FSCA has done that, and most importantly, how consumers can keep themselves safe.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So earlier in the week on the National Pulse, you would have heard Ashraf Garda taking a look at the safety concerns around the liquefied gas market. We're going to be taking a look at this from a slightly different perspective. We're going to be taking a look at the regulatory requirements of liquefied petroleum gas and how it should be used. The illicit market itself in the LPG space is now 25% of the market, and it presents a new set of challenges that all players have to be alive to and have to contend with. I'm joined on the line by the Managing Director of the Liquefied Petroleum Gas Association of South Africa, Radibulai Dihlabi, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Radi, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start the conversation with the importance of regulation in the LPG space. LPG gas, much like any other commodity in South Africa, very useful in the sense of where it sits in our energy mix, but it is regulated in its own right.
Good evening to you, Jimmy, and the listeners. Thank you for giving us the opportunity. True, LPG or LP gas, as people call it, is really providing that access to energy, even in areas that predominantly do not have access to even cleaner energy. But also, it's winter in South Africa. We are an LPG user country in winter. But yes, there are problems that we are encountering as an industry, especially now with winter when the usage is on the rise and demand is on the rise. And somehow, when it comes to regulations, like any other sector in South Africa, enforcement is weak in the LPG sector as well.
Khadi, how did we get to a point of 25% of the market being supplied through illicit means. You mentioned enforcement has been a problem in this respect, but if we are thinking about the use cases, where does the illicit market even come from if we have regulated parties and regulated supply?
Okay, so if you remember prior to COVID, or maybe prior to problems of electricity, LPG was not really that prevalent in South Africa for use. It was just another rich people energy source to us. They go camping with it. But the issues of load shedding and Eskom came to party, and people had to look for alternative fuels. And LPG was present, was available for people to look into. However, the market was so small, and distributors were so small at that time. And in areas where LPG was not that big, widely used, that's where we started seeing the cropping of this illicit market. And by the time, it is my belief, by the time the compliant distributors and wholesalers woke up to the situation, those other markets were already captured by this illicit market. Unfortunately, they were then using the assets that belong to this market. I know that this week there's been a talk around winter mafias. No, this is not a winter problem. This is an all-year problem. This is organized syndicate group. They operate outside, inside Johannesburg. They operate in big centers, and they then pack the cylinders into their trucks and take them to other areas like Free State, Northwest, where LPG distribution and compliant distributors are not so concentrated like in this market. So that's where the problem has been around so much, and that's how the illicit market grew.
Khadi, what's the biggest risk for the market at the moment? Let's take a look at it from two perspectives. Those that are legitimate and licensed service providers, but also from a consumer perspective. These two groups, what are their biggest risks?
So you do remember that LPG is a flammable substance. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, not used well can lead to death. That is the biggest risk for anybody in this industry and for the country as a whole. So what then the non-compliant, and you can here call them non-compliant operators bring is that there is circumventing of the regulations that exist. They don't have time to invest in regulations. We understand regulations cost money. They don't have time nor desire to invest in regulations for them to operate legitimate businesses. They would rather circumvent and skip and cut corners in every way they can so that they can make that quick money that is presented by the industry.
Khadi, what needs to be done here from an industry perspective, from those that form part of associations like the LPGSA to protect the industry? We understand, of course, that individuals out there might be embarking on these businesses to perhaps earn a living, to perhaps make a little extra money. But as you rightly mentioned, it's important to do so the right way and do so as in line with the laws and regulations of the country. What needs to be done here to protect this industry and to reduce the impact of this illicit market?
So I think it starts first with enforcement. We have regulations that are standing. We have bylaws in every municipality that are standing. Regulations, and from the perspective of pressure equipment regulations being managed by the Department of Employment and Labor, the national standards that give guidance into operations of LPG, compliant operations of LPG, enforced through the same regulations. The transport regulations that requires how LPG should be transported. And the enforcement thereof lies with law enforcement and the inspectors of those departments respectively. So that is number one. Then you have on the other side the responsibilities of business, investing in those markets that otherwise do not have access to compliant, you know, distributors. That is the best thing that they can do to protect the industry, but also to protect South African safety.
Khadi, before I let you go, if South Africans are wondering whether or not the gas that they are purchasing is purchased from a legitimate service provider or from an illicit source, how can South Africans tell very quickly whether or not this product is safe and sold correctly?
Okay, so when you go and buy your gas, you holding a cylinder, you say, I want to buy gas, and somebody is refilling it for you, but they are refilling a branded cylinder, stay away from that person. Just know that they are selling illicit gas and anything can happen with that cylinder. Overfilled, underfilled, all sorts of things can be added into that LPG. That is if you are going to buy gas. If you are exchanging and you get to a service station, because there it happens as well, and you find a TS seal that does not match the brand that's sitting on the bottle that you are buying, you must also refrain from buying that, because that is for your safety and the safety of your community. Those are the simplest things that I can educate consumers about.
Ghadi, why am I looking for the seals to match, or why am I looking for the brands to match? Is it because those branded cylinders are the responsibility of that particular service provider and they themselves need to adhere to certain regulations?
Precisely that. So each cylinder has a unique identification. Each seal has a unique identification that matches that cylinder bottle. So let's say, for example, an incident occurred and it's Jimmy's brand on that seal and on that cylinder. The first point of investigation is at Jimmy's plant. Jimmy has to show that this cylinder was last filled in my premises during this time or at this time, and it went out to this area, and it has been maintained over this time. They have to provide all that history with that cylinder. Now, if Jimmy is an illicit refiller, he won't have that history. So that's why the maintenance of a cylinder lies with the cylinder owner brand. So if you are the brand owner, it is your responsibility. And in case of an incident, you are the first point of contact.
It's important, folks, to be very, very careful where it is you procure your gas from, particularly at times like this where we do see an increase in demand in the requirements that we have for our gas uses. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Managing Director of the Liquefied Petroleum Gas Association of South Africa, Ghadi Bulaye Dihlabi, joining us to take a look at the importance of only procuring regulated and licensed gas, or gas from licensed regulated operators.
Executive Lounge, where top leaders share their business insights and life lessons on SAFM.
Relax. You're okay. Your new Volvo plug-in hybrid will get you there and back again, and there again and back again. Because you're at least 80 kilometers of electric range away from having to worry about petrol or the battery, which comes with an 8-year warranty. But it will keep you going for much, much longer than that. Test drive a Volvo plug-in hybrid.
It is Executive Lounge time on a Wednesday. We take this time to get to know leading executives a little bit beyond their day-to-day responsibilities. This week's executive is a gentleman who's probably been an actuary longer than most people have been in school, possibly even longer than most Gen Zs have been alive. Joined on the line by Chief Executive Officer at Discovery Life, Rian van Rienen, to take a look at what it is he gets up to beyond his day-to-day responsibilities. Well, Rian, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. In 1994, what was the thought process when you were at UNISA thinking you wanted to do actuarial sciences? Was this always the plan?
Yes, I think from an early kind of age during my school career, I enjoyed doing mathematics, and I was introduced to this career prospect of actuarial science and becoming an actuary, and that kind of immediately appealed to me, the combination of maths and the financial world. And yeah, I guess when I did a little bit of research, it really started appealing to me, and that's how I got into studying actuarial science at Tikkies, but really enjoyed it, and I guess the rest is history.
Fast forward to today, and looking at where the world is with all of the uncertainty and with all of the risk that sits in the world, would you have thought that one of the leading professions in assessing risk, if not the leading profession for assessing risk, would be so popular?
I don't think I had any clue back then. If I rewind back to your first question back to 1994, I did have a clue that it's a fairly scarce occupation, and that it covers a wide spectrum of financial risks, and from short-term to long-term insurance and pensions and investment. But I think just the way that actuarial science have evolved over the years, and just the wider fields where actuaries are contributing now, is definitely wider than I would have guessed. So it's great to see just how the profession has expanded and just the impact across various industries.
Well, more than 30 years later, it is still a scarce profession, even though it has grown significantly. Well, Mrian, I want to take a look at life beyond the Discovery family. I mean, having been at Discovery in many roles and across various departments and divisions to now being the head of Discovery Life, have you ever imagined life outside of Discovery? Not necessarily from a professional perspective, but just from a company perspective.
Jimmy, I've actually started my career in a small short-term insurer before I moved to Discovery Health and then eventually Discovery Life. So I have seen various other areas, albeit for a short period of time. But I think I really found my passion working at Discovery, and the core purpose of making people healthier and combining that with actuarial techniques and just enjoying applying actuarial science to making people's finances healthier as well as them physically healthier really resonates. So I can't really see how that would manifest in many other areas. So I think I found that sweet spot, and I'm very comfortable and very happy.
What's a pet peeve that you have around health? Around perhaps how humans are approaching their health? What really, really grinds your nerves when it comes to that?
Probably the single most thing is the notion that I can wait till tomorrow. Tomorrow will be better than today. I don't have to really look after my health today in terms of exercise or going for that medical screening. Tomorrow's another day and I'll do it, and I'll have more courage to do things tomorrow than I have today. And I think that's a really important message. It's just don't put off anything. Do what you need to do today and go on that journey and get healthier today.
Well, Mrian, what's the bravest thing you've ever done, or that you would consider the bravest thing you've ever done?
Sure. I'm not sure necessarily about brave. I've done a few stupid things in my life. If that's like
bungee, counts just as much.
Jumping when I was a student and things like that, which is probably brave and stupid at the same time. But I think brave is more, in my mind, is more about taking that step into the unknown, leading people in a situation that you never have, or just taking a step that you never have done. And I respect people for doing that, going out of their comfort zone.
What does your comfort zone look like? What is something that brings you great comfort after a hard day's work, perhaps after a hard week in the office? What does comfort look like?
Comfort for me is mostly spending time with my family. We've got quite a close-knit family. So, I mean, that's where I get my energy from. Just spending time with people that I love and just unwinding there. I also enjoy exercise, running, mountain biking, being outdoors, boating, water activity. So really being active and outside. Not that you can do that every day after work, but a lot of the energy on a day-to-day basis, I would say, I draw from my family and just people that I connect with.
Mrian, what would your family say is the quirkiest trait that you have when it comes to food?
I enjoy a lot of food. I wouldn't say I'm very picky when it comes to food. I enjoy from fine dining to just normal having a braai with friends. So I don't think there's too many quirks, actually. It's maybe that I'm very easygoing and can adapt to almost anything that's in front of me. And
food and a love for family hold Rian van Rienen close and keep him grounded. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Mrian, thank you so much for the time and for the insights. We'll continue the conversation, but for now it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means the SAFM news team is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team with what undoubtedly will be a good build-up towards our Bafana game later on. From my side, good night.